Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast from WNYC, made on Varick Street.
While we know writer Ralph Ellison best as the author of the acclaimed 1952 novel Invisible Man, he was also a musician, a critic, a teacher, and, as it turns out, a record collector. In 2007, more than a decade after his death, his large collection of records was given to the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, and now they're on display there in an exhibit called Ralph Ellison, A Man and His Records. Lauren Schoenberg is the artistic director of the museum, as well as a jazz historian and musician himself, and joins me here in the Soundcheck studio today. Welcome back, Lauren.
Great to see you, John, as always.
So, for people who are familiar with the book Invisible Man, you know, they know that our narrator is a black man living in a kind of a basement space. He's kind of a squatter, and he's obsessed with not just recordings, but one recording in particular, and that is Louis Armstrong's What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue? Please tell me this is in the exhibit.
It is, and it's quite interesting because Ralph Ellison's own copy, his 78 copy of Black and Blue, didn't survive. I think he probably played it to death. Mm. So we had an LP version, you know, because the novel was written in the late 40s, early 50s.
Right.
So what did we do? We went to the Louis Armstrong Archive at Queens College, and we are displaying Louis Armstrong's copy of his What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue in place of Ralph's own LP copy.
So Ralph only had one copy.
I have no idea how many copies he had.
Because let me read this passage from the novel Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. Right. Now I have one radio phonograph. I plan to have five. There is a certain acoustical deadness in my hole, and when I have music, I want to feel its vibration, not only with my ear, but with my entire body. I'd like to hear five recordings of Louis Armstrong playing and singing What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue, all at the same time.
All after bed, spring hard as lead, feel like old Ned, wish I was dead. All my life through, I've been so black and blue. Even the mouse ran from my house. They laugh at you and scorn you too. What did I do then to be so black and blue? Oh, I'm white inside, but that don't help my case. How will it end? Ain't got a friend. My only sin is in my skin. What did I do to be so black and blue?
We're speaking with Lauren Schoenberg, artistic director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, about their new exhibit called Ralph Ellison, A Man and His Records. It's there until at least the end of April, but Lauren, what's on display at the museum isn't just a bunch of records. There are excerpts from articles that Ellison wrote, and there are some pretty striking photos, including one of Ralph Ellison on his first day at the Tuskegee Institute, and he's got a bandage on his head because he was beaten up while traveling there.
Yes, he was. Ralph Ellison's story is an amazing story. I mean, it's actually almost more amazing than the story told in Invisible Man. It's a couple of biographies about him, one by Jackson, one by Rampersad. And make a long story short, you know, he's born in Oklahoma and tremendously challenging childhood. Father wasn't there, mother.
Well, his father died, right,
yes,
when he was three.
Absolutely, raising the kids. And he had this insatiable, his father named him Ralph Waldo Ellison.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's almost like, you know, when Barack Obama was born or when Abraham Lincoln was born, if you said, could this child, if you could see Abe or if you could see Barry at five, and you would say, could this kid from this background become president of the United States? I don't think so, right? And in the same sense, Ralph Waldo Ellison being born into this situation in Oklahoma City in 1913.
Grandson of slaves.
He's going to become one of the great American writers of all time.
Right.
Especially, you know.
Well, his dad must have thought so to give him that name.
His father had great aspirations for him. And it's just really an amazing story. But to get back to the picture that you referred to. I saw in one of the biographies a pretty poor 19th generation Xeroxed copy of a picture of Ralph Ellison with a huge bandage, white bandage on his forehead. It was very striking. So we reached out to Tuskegee, and we actually got to use in the collection, with their permission, you know, a digital scan of the original photograph. Mm-hmm. And make a long story short, he tried to go to college. His first attempt didn't work. Eventually he was going to go to Tuskegee and had to hobo on the trains. And hoboing was very, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And he got beaten up on the way there. And the way that he arrived at Tuskegee is beaten. And this became his registration photo. And the reason that I think it's very important to have that photo is Ralph Ellison went through a lot of changes in the 1960s and 70s, where he was perceived to be old-fashioned, mm-hmm. speaking to an old view of the black experience. Last week at the museum, we had Stanley Crouch and Bob O'Mealy, and they were talking about the tremendously difficult time that Ralph Ellison had in the 1960s and 70s on the campuses, where he was viewed as old-fashioned. He was actually called an Uncle Tom, of all things, and he was rejected in kind of a cultural patricide by a lot of the leading lights of the day. And that photo brings back very vividly. This is a man who went through not only intellectual understanding. Well, I mean, he was an African-American man in America at that time. But the photo of him beaten just puts an emphasis on it, that this is where he was coming from.
And he was going to college to study music. I mean, that was his first love. And the writing thing was kind of a detour off of his intended path.
You know, John, the first thing that really struck a chord in Ralph Ellison's heart was the sound of jazz music. I mean, it's so poetic, kind of wafting at night through Oklahoma City, hearing this legendary territory band, Walter Page's Blue Devils, which was the antecedent of the Count Basie Band.
Speaking with Lauren Schoenberg, who is artistic director at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, musician himself, jazz historian, and the exhibit up till at least the end of April is called Ralph Ellison, A Man and His Records. And how many records are we talking about?
Well, there were about 1,500 records in the collection, a smattering of 78s. Uh-huh. Some of them did survive. But for the most part, 10-inch LPs, 12-inch LPs, some 12-inch 78 albums. But what they really do, John, is they give us a, I don't know whether you want to say an X-ray, into his musical life, into his artistic life, the sheer breadth and depth of the things that he listened to.
Right.
Really fascinating.
And he wrote about, I mean, at the museum you can read Ralph Ellison's own profile of Mahalia Jackson, who, the great gospel singer, something he wrote for the Saturday Review in 1958. And one of the albums you have there is Mahalia Jackson's 1947 record, this one, in fact, called Move On Up a Little Higher.
Monday morning, soon morning, gonna lead up a cross, get me a crown. Late in the evening, oh!
Jackson. We're just singing along.
We're just both sitting here, just in her orbit, man.
Yeah, Jesus. Yeah. Ralph Ellison was a big fan of Mahalia Jackson, as was Duke Ellington, and there seems to have been an Ellison Ellington connection as well. In as if this record collection is any indication, because there's tons of Ellington in it.
You know, in many ways, Ellington and Ellison are comparable figures.
How so?
Well, I tend to shy away from the word greatest, but in my estimation, no composer represents America of the 20th century as well as Ellington does in its totality. The use of improvisation, the not caring so much about Western forms, I mean classical forms.
Ostensibly, although he did care enough about them to be able to use them to his own ends.
Well, that's the whole thing, because he studied with someone who studied with Dvorak, who famously said, you know, find your own answers, you know, don't imitate us, you know. And Ellison, in the same way, is really the highest voice of the African-American experience in the 20th century. And they were both, in a sense, I wouldn't say autodidacts. I mean, Ellison went to college for a few years. But Ellington also had great mentors who he studied with who were very advanced. And now, you know, as we're over a decade into the 21st century, I think that we can see in retrospect Ellington and Ellison really as the high watermark.
Although the thing that sort of distinguishes the two is Ellington left behind a huge body of work, whereas Ellison comes bursting out of the gate, first novel, Invisible Man, 1952, National Book Award, everybody loves him, and then nothing.
Well, not nothing,
but in terms of second novels, we got nothing until after he died.
Let's say, John, that within the next week or so, someone saved your life. And then
why would they do that?
Because they love your show. But anyway, make long story short. And then when they gave that person's epitaph, they said, "But you know, he only saved one life."
Yeah.
And so to approach it from the angle of why he didn't do more, I mean, gee, you know, there's a great anecdote. You would love this in a Saul Bellow introduction to one of the Ellison things, in which he says, you know, some dowager approached Albert Einstein and was talking about something, and he was talking about why is there only one quantum or one something or other, and he looked mad at him. He said, "I think one is quite enough." So, you know, Ellison wrote a wonderful book called Shadow and Act of essays. Then there's another book after that.
He wrote lots of music criticism, lots of writing about
absolutely.
Music and the music that he was
loving. And of course, posthumously, they did publish something that originally was called Juneteenth, which is an extra. But no, there's no doubt. And we were talking about this last week with Stanley Crouch and Bob O'Mealy, who knew him, that there was the anxiety of what to do next.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Almost like the writer's version of stage fright, it sounds like, you know, once you're...
Well, no, because, I don't know. Stage fright might stop someone from going on the stage or inhibit their performance. Ellison wrote.
Yeah.
He wrote voluminously. His problem was the anxiety of form, from what I understand. He had tremendous amount of material, and it seems as though his struggle was organizing it into something that he felt was coherent.
We mentioned, you know, all these Ellington records. What Am I Here For is the B-side of one of those Ellington records that Ralph Ellison owned. Ellington's What Am I Here For is one of the many Ellington records that Ralph Ellison owned, and his collection now on display at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. It's called Ralph Ellison, A Man and His Records. And, Lauren, what do we learn about Ralph Ellison as a man from his records?
What we learn is that he was the antithesis of someone who was myopic.
He had a wide-angle view of our culture.
He listened to everything. Everything that interested him. A lot of classical music, a lot of jazz, a lot of what now is called world music. Long before, how many people had records of, you know, African drum ensembles, music from Hungary, just all kinds of what would be for the time very unusual things, especially for somebody who was predisposed, whose whole life's work was trying to define himself as an African American.
Were you surprised at the amount of classical music in Ralph Ellison's collection?
You know, I wasn't, John, only because I had read about how he went to Tuskegee, studied classical. He was studied, I believe, at Persichetti. He was going to be a classical composer and a concert trumpet player.
Right.
So it would only make sense. What surprised me was the primacy of vocal music, regardless of the idiom, whether it's Bessie Smith, whether it's Mahalia Jackson, and he writes, you mentioned the essay that he did in Saturday Review, where he writes about Mahalia Jackson, and he says in so many words, you know, you can buy her records, or you can go see her at a jazz concert, or on the Ed Sullivan Show if she's on, but to really hear what she's about, you have to hear her in a church.
Mm-hmm.
And he zeroes in on all these things, and there were a handful of singers. Leontine Price, of course, for any number of reasons, should be obvious.
Great African-American soprano, right. You know, groundbreaking in the world of opera.
Yeah. Absolutely right, and a great artist. And Bessie Smith, Paul Robeson, and Miss Ferrier.
Kathleen Ferrier, the English singer.
Yes, there's one essay where he writes about how, you know, he got so into writing and so deep into it, and so deep into jazz, and deep into African-American idioms, that he was kind of, in a sense, getting further away from the quote-unquote classical music that had first entranced him. And it was hearing a recording by her that just brought him slam, bang, back into that world.
This is all physical stuff. Could this ever happen in the digital age? Is it the same thing to get somebody's iPod after they pass on?
I lost mine yesterday. No, of course not. And you and I are the same generation. So we know what it's like to fondle an LP, to read the liner notes, to keep taking that disc out, to play it. It's a physical thing. And you're absolutely right now. And it'll be very curious to see what happens. Luckily, Ralph Ellison didn't have that problem.
The exhibit is called Ralph Ellison, A Man and His Records, on display at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem at least through the end of April. We've been speaking with artistic director Lauren Schoenberg. Lauren, great to see you again. And let's hear a little bit from Kathleen Ferrier. The Soundcheck podcast is supported by people just like you. Make a contribution or become a monthly sustainer. Just go to soundcheck.org and click on support. Thanks for listening. I'm John Schaefer.